really sucks.
But right there, one curative quality is simply to recognize that, you're grasping for this thing. That's been the problem all along. The ego is always grasping for some assuagement of its insecurity, right? So
how is that curative, though?
I guess you just train in this in meditation. That's where you have to train in it. Because your states of mind, if you sit there long enough, all they do is come and go. Mm-hmm. And some of them really suck, and some of them are neutral and boring, and some of them are sometimes you get excited or you're pleased at your sequence of thoughts. And beyond that, you might start to have meditative experiences where you are feeling calm, or you're feeling blissful. And you sit there long enough, and you probably don't have to sit there too long, that goes away too. Mm-hmm. But the goal all along was not to get to the perfect state, because that's what ego is trying to do.
Yes.
The goal is to show up completely, to be completely present, because that's what you've been missing all along. That is the actual assuagement of suffering, an unconditional presence of mind that is not holding on to anything, grasping and fixating on anything, but is relaxed into its innate nature, that empty, luminous nature of mind.
But the path there, and this is what just came up for me around, it sucks in the beginning. But a lot of things do in the beginning. And that's one thing I found that's really strange in meditation. What is initially deeply unsettling eventually becomes very comforting, right? And even in that other example where I have to tell people, you do have a substance use disorder. Right? This is what we call that. At first, it can be really painful to hear that. But that ultimately is, you need to know that in order to start the process of getting out of this.
The truth will set you free, Joseph.
But at first, it will make you suffer.
Yes.
At first.
Yep.
And when you're sitting on a cushion and you start to experience, I remember grabbing the cushion. The first time you start to experience this openness, this emptiness, and the mind starts to relax back into itself, and you can start to lose yourself a bit. You're looking for something to grab.
Yeah, scares the hell out of the ego. The ego responds, holy shit, don't do that.
Right. Get back in there. Get back in the house, mind. So talk about this. How this mind that is grasping and fixated, how that grasping and fixation effectively distorts the experience.
Well, you aren't open to things as they happen. You're imposing a pattern of thinking upon it.
How is that different from just confirmation bias? Or is that confirmation bias is a part of that? Right? You see what you're looking to see. You'll find what you're looking for, right? If you're depressed or if you have poor self-image, you will look, and that's part of the experience machine, right? You will look, and your mind will emphasize some people that are being critical of you and will ignore people that are being supportive of you in order to make that reality true.
Right, or the opposite. It's the habituation that is what we're, intoxicated by, or it's almost like a prescription sedative or something.
So is it a stretch to say the reality you experience is not much more than a visual, auditory, gustatory, olfactory, mental representation of those habitual patterns? For most people, until you break free from that. That is what you're seeing. You're seeing.
All right. Well, there's some information that's going on there that is in the absolutely relatively accurate, right? You, if I can put it that way. Like, you take a shower in the shower, but you don't take a shower in the, you know, burning hearth or something,
yes.
Right?
Yes.
So that's on the level of like schizophrenia or something. You're so out of it that even the sensory information is inaccurate. But the relative sensory information is there and has to be respected. And it's a natural quality of truth that's being expressed. And to be in sync with that is a very different mindset than the one that's always interpreting it, filtering it through preconception. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, you may have some things might be pretty identifiable. Maybe you're just afraid of homeless people. So if you pass one on the street, I mean, if you could, let's say you consider them dangerous, and of course sometimes they are, but sometimes people who are not homeless are way worse. But anyway, right? So person could just be, as they say, sometimes homeless people are. They're just sitting there on the street with a lot of open-heartedness. You don't see the open-heartedness. You impose the label you've developed and conditioned yourself to believe. Or other people have told you and you believe them, and they did the conditioning and you accepted it. And then you operate according to that way, and then you filter things accordingly.
Mm-hmm. So Andy Clark says that the brain, in order to experience that semi-objective truth, the brain has to focus attention more on the incoming data than on its preconceived notions.
Well, yes, and absolutely. Of course.
And if it can do that in a non-judgmental way, I think we would label that mindfulness.
Sure, mindfulness ideally brings you to the moment where you're just paying attention to it openly. Yes. You're not coming to a conclusion about it. You're just paying attention to it. And therefore, the information starts to be more accurate.
Yes, because it's not going straight into judgment there's conceptuality certainly, but it's not, you're not allowing the mind to live in its story, largely regardless of the data. It's dropping the story a little bit in order to experience what's here without my stories. Right, that's what Locke Kelly gets into those prompts a lot. Like, what's here? He likes to say, like, what's here now when there's no problems to solve? Like, and it can really shift your reality. I mean, these are mind-bending meditations, little glimpse meditations, because they're directly offering your mind another alternative than swimming in its BS story.
Yeah, and the story. Remember the passion, aggression, and ignorance thing. That those are the base instincts that are running the pattern. So you're walking down the street, you know, in the homeless person example, then you feel aversion. Or maybe that's just so irrelevant to your story. You don't even see them. all you see is the thing that you're heading towards,
mm-hmm.
what you're desiring to get to accomplish.
Yeah.
And then you have aversion to anything that interferes with that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Maybe how long the street light is taking to shift so that you can cross or whatever. It's played out on that level all the time, but then that's how you make your daily life into path. Path from delusion or egocentrism to openness.
But that fundamentally, right, like in the West we have this saying, you know, beauty is in the eye of the beholder. I assume that comes from the West. Maybe somebody in the East said it first. I don't know. I doubt it.
I think it's Western.
But we never took that to the full extent, right? The reason there's the grasping and fixation and aversion is because, like, when you see a rainbow, the beauty or goodness of that rainbow is coming from your mind. And the rainbow is coming from your mind, too. The whole thing, yep. The whole thing is coming from your mind. But when you're suffering under that fundamental ignorance and you don't know that, you then think, in order to have that object's goodness, I have to get it into my territory somehow.
Yeah.
And in order to avoid that thing's badness, I have to get it out of my territory somehow. And the whole operation is kind of ridiculous because you're the one that put the goodness on the object. Yet you don't know that, so you go grasping and running away from, and because fundamentally you have no idea that you're the one doing it all.
Yeah.
And if you could reconnect with that, right? If you could say, like, I don't have to get that object's goodness. I am the goodness. And if I can experience that without the object, it's like the object is just a prop to show you an aspect of you. But you don't know that because of this dualistic fixation that we're so stuck in, right?
Almost a labyrinthine level of interference,
yes.
from habitual ways of perceiving. Like everything becomes, you know, something I got to get or something I got to avoid or something I got to fight with or something I got to compete with or something that makes me depressed or something that makes me doubtful. And
I need to impress. I need to, so I can get, I can keep these people in my territory.
Yeah, so
they
the whole
keep me in theirs.
Passion, aggression, ignorance are the roots, and then the tree just blossoms, you know, all kinds of toxicity, toxic flowers and leaves from there.
Okay, so then once you've established the whole dumpster fire and you're running around for decades crazily chasing after and running away from and trying to ignore the rest, so it doesn't overwhelm you, which is getting darn near impossible. We're now exposed to more information in a single day than human beings were in their entire life, you know, a couple hundred years ago. How is...
And it may well be dumber information, though we don't believe that.
Right. Right. May well be. I think I'd go a little further than that.
You never know.
Yeah. But how... So then how is... We talked a little bit so far about mindfulness. How is meditation the antidote to all of this dumpster fire?
No, it's probably not the only antidote, but it's a fundamental way of you getting to know yourself. And
you getting to know the self or the mind?
Yourself, mind, consciousness.
Okay,
well,
so
if we're saying that the problem starts internally with how you perceive the world and your habitual perceptions of it, well, that's what you have to examine. That's what you have to work with, and that's what you can do in meditation because it's not, there's nothing external there. You're just sitting with yourself. So you start to see yourself. You start to see what your mind creates, how it does it. Start to see what you think.
But I think you redefined, when we were talking about self, we were talking about identification with the ego function.
Yeah.
And I think there you took self, the word self, and broadened it.
Well, just in a relative sense, like you were saying, you know, someone's got to feed this. Something's got to feed this body. It's got to know that it's got to feed itself. And so it's got to know that it's got to learn about itself because it's become very confused. And so you sit there and you're starting to, you start to know about the confusion because you're looking at it. No one's interpreting it for you. We can sit here and talk about it endlessly, and you can read endless books on it. But, you know, experientially, look for yourself and see what happens.
And, you know, various beings throughout time, including the Buddha, if you sit there long enough, your mind will unwind this mess and figure it out. Right? Effectively, experientially figure it out, not conceptually necessarily, but it'll figure it out. It'll see it. I mean, that's what somebody had to do this first without instructions, right? But we now have instructions. We've developed to make it go faster.
Yeah, like because it could take a really long time if you just, with no help, sat there. So you do need to read some books, maybe, or you need to listen to these conversations or something to help you figure out how to go about it. It's like, I'd like to make something that could, you know, it could get me from this town to that town a lot faster. What should I do?
Yes.
Well, we already know how to build a car, so you figure out how to build a car, you know.
Yeah.
And maybe you want to change how it's done, but you start by knowing how it's made. You
know? So is it a stretch or is it, not disrespectful, but is it a oversimplistic way of saying that meditation is the various meditation methods are ways of speeding this process up?
Sure. Skillful means.
So then there must be, and of course I know that there is, but there must be a vigorous debate then among the various methods.
Yeah.
As to who's got the fastest one.
Yeah, certainly my tradition. That's a lot of it. I spend a lot of time figuring out. Well, okay, so here's how you do it. Here's how you count to one, you know? But once you can count to one, we got this whole two thing that comes after that. And then eventually you're all the way up to calculus and trigonometry, and then there's like the beyond of that.
Well, then why hasn't it settled? Because one of the things is I found most difficult about Buddhism is that when I started getting into it, I didn't realize that I was reading things from vastly different traditions that often contradicted one another.
Yep.
And I didn't know, I wasn't oriented to where I even was in the canon.
Yep.
And why haven't in, you know, 2,500 years, why haven't things settled out?
But that's how they got that complicated, because traditions developed in different places and they have their own involved formats and the way they work on things. But
there'd be some consolidation. Like if they started talking to each other, the Zen Buddhists started talking to the Tibetans and say, well, let's figure this out, right? Like, why isn't there an equally scientific process like we do in science? Like, test it out and see who's got the best method? Why isn't something like that going on?
Well, they did that in India, you know. As far as global, all the traditions globally go, it's fairly recent that they started to talk to each other at all.
Yes. So that's
different sects of different traditions are always inclined to fight with each other. So
egos.
You know,
organizational egos.
It's not that important. But you can take, you know, you can take a couple of views here, and one is you yourself may just take more to one style than another, one set of forms than another. And then depending on how much you've developed, methods, some methods are more useful than others. And the ultimate method, according to the Tibetan tradition, is that there's no method at all, right? You just rest in the nature of mind. There's no method. That's the method. That's the ultimate method, because that's what you were trying to do all along. But you may have to work through kinds of things in kind of more limited but very practical ways. Like if you're very angry, you may have to remind yourself constantly not to get angry. Mm-hmm. If you're just resting in a state of mind, nature of mind, then anger comes up and anger goes away and nothing happens. But in order to rest in that mind, boy, you got to do a lot of work. And it's not just meditation. It matters how you conduct yourself in your daily life. It matters a great, very great deal. It matters also how you look at things and your point of view on them. And all of that needs development. You can't just snap your fingers. Can't take a pill. You can't download it off the internet. Nothing is going to work. It has to be internal work you do. And you say, well, that's very hard and that's too much effort. Fine. And nothing will change in your circumstance. So if you don't have the heart to care about yourself and your life and the people around you, if you don't have that heart, well, nothing will happen at all.
Nothing will happen at all.
In terms of you making any real dent in your habitual mind or your tendency to fall asleep in your confusion or all the suffering that comes out of that, nothing will happen to it unless you take the bull by the horns at some level.
But even if you try to, I mean, I've had clients come in and report that they've been meditating for 20 years and are effectively nowhere. Like it gives them some time. It's like they get some alone time, which is good. They calm down a little bit, which is good. But clients have reported to me, in fact, they're coming to see me because they are frustrated because nothing's happening. And they believe they're following, they have teachers, which is interesting, because some teachers will just say, just keep going. That's not my experience in the Tibetan tradition. It's a bit more dynamic than that.
Well, I don't know what exactly the issues are. I mean, you can practice and it can affect you. But, you know, maybe that is a limited thing.
Yes.
And maybe you're not cultivating other things like compassion. Maybe you're not challenging your states of mind as they come up. Maybe you're not, you know, putting effort, true effort into your conduct and interaction. So maybe it helps you. Because if it just puts some calm into your day, and this is kind of secular, the malaise of secular mindfulness, how that it kind of stuckness it has, that's what you get. I mean, it's coming out of your effort and intention. And
because your effort is not the way, in some cases, your intention may not be to wake the mind up and achieve some kind of realization.
You're just making yourself feel better, right? And calming down, and that probably is not only a help to yourself, but it's a help to the people around you that you're calmer.
Yes.
From it.
Sure.
And less stress. If you put 20 minutes a day into meditating for 20 years, let's say. Well, you know, that's very habitual too. And my goodness, what would happen if you suddenly sat for an hour?
Right. Yeah.
And you might feel a lot, you suddenly lose your ground. Your calmness goes away. And you know, now you're dealing with more of the mind. But that, you know, here, there's the rub. Like we were saying earlier, you have to face the suffering. You have to face the suffering or nothing's going to happen.
Yes. Yeah, there's
that's
the
part of the path.
And if you're not if the situation is not producing any suffering, that there's no material to work with. Now, I separate for my clients what I'm calling mindful relaxation and meditation as mind training, right?
Yeah.
And I always tell them, like, mindful relaxation is a really important thing to do. It's good for you. You should do that every day. You should relax and be mindful while you're relaxing.
Yeah, try being mindful of everything all the time, though.
Right, that's a very different story, right?
Yes. It takes real effort on your part, because I would suspect that those people are not genuinely putting the effort in that it's going to take. They've kept in some strata of comfort zone.
Yes, yes.
They're limited by comfort, and that's been the problem we all have all along, that we're absorbed in habitual patterns because they comfort us, and then you make a habitual pattern of meditating or mindfulness.
Okay. Well, I think this has been it's been a fascinating discussion of kind of, in just over an hour, we've covered how the entire dumpster fire of suffering gets going. That's pretty incredible. And we're starting to get into how we unwind this mess. So thanks very much. And I guess to be continued, huh?
Absolutely.